philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Negative. I am a meat popsicle.
You call me a mindless philosopher, you overweight glob of grease.
I'm gonna have to science the shit out of this.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 21, right?
This is episode 22. You skipped.
Well, that's
you
weird. 21. By my count. By my count, it's the 21st episode.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Done,
yes,
so.
You're mad about being locked outside. Yeah. I understand.
I was locked outside of the air. The hatch.
That was pretty much the situation. I gave you enough
sealed
oxygen.
Out.
It was fine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh really? So yeah. That's how I survived the week, I guess.
Okay. Well, I've let you back in, and now you can hang out.
I didn't know that though. I was pretty worried. Yeah, but no. All right, it's episode 22. And thanks so much to Callie for stepping in last week. I'm real sad I missed it, but we definitely have to have Callie back. And I won't miss that one. We'll make Aaron miss that one. No, I'm just kidding. All right. I am so excited because we are going to be talking about one of my favorite movies. And I can't wait to talk about it. And I also can't wait for Aaron to inevitably tell me it's not as good as it or something. I don't know. There's going to be somehow it won't work out, but I don't know. We'll see.
I'm painfully aware of all of the detritus that is constantly shedding off of my body now. I appreciate that. Thanks, movie. you don't come away from this movie being like, oh God, I'm shedding hair everywhere.
Oh,
all of this dirt around me is me. What is going on?
Yeah, I'm like, man, I don't scrub myself with rocks quite enough. Maybe I need to be doing that more.
I wonder if this is like a kind of a fetish movie for neat freaks. Like, do they watch those scenes and really like it?
Probably. Until the parts where he like puts back someone else's
right,
skin
that's
flakes
it's like a
stuff.
Torture porn.
That's got to be pretty disturbing. Yeah. Oh man. Okay. So we're talking about Gattaca, 1997. I can't even believe it's that old. Although I mean now I believe it, but having rewatched it. But yeah, it's been probably since gosh, probably been 13 years since I've watched it or something like that. But I remembered it really fondly, and it's one of those things where I'm always. Those movies where you liked them 10 whatever years ago and then you're like, crap, was that really good? Or if I watch it again, is it going to be dated or something? Or is it going to be terrible? And I got to say, this is not a perfect movie. Like there's some bad acting. There's some bad directing here and there. But like conceptually, which is why I wonder how you'll feel about it. Conceptually, if someone had presented this as like, here's the outline for a movie. Like here's all the characters. Here's the concept. Here's what they will do. I'd be like, that's an 11 out of 10. That's a perfect movie. Like that much of it, the structure of it, like what happens for me, I love it. I absolutely love it. And, you know, there's some weaknesses here and there that are like, okay. But for me, I just overwhelmingly feel so positive about this movie and what happens and how it's written that I absolutely enjoyed it, even though it's from 1997 and a little
bit. I agree. I think it holds up well. There is one major critique that I will get to at one point that is a of its time kind of issue, but I think if it was to be done today, they would have to correct it. But besides that problem, I think it does a really great job.
You are, of course, talking about not casting Ethan Hawke.
Right, exactly. Not casting Ethan Hawke because he's terrible.
Be the one. We'll get to that.
Yeah. No, I do think that it raises a lot of interesting problems well, and that it shows that it holds up because it's still being continuously referenced today. I think that it's become a really great cultural touchstone for people to sort of tiptoe into the idea of the upsides and downsides, and also the potentially dangerous ideologies that make up potentially more of a concern than the technology itself. So,
yeah. And I was wondering like, hey, how is this so good? Like who wrote this thing? And turns out it's the same guy who wrote The Truman Show. So like this
it
person
does
is just
feel
a
like The Truman Show now I that mean, you mention it. You're right.
It's two movies that like stand the test of time and predict the future. And like, you know what I mean? Like this guy, man, his name is Andrew Nicole or something. It says he's New Zealand born. But wow, he He's a good writer. Okay, so, but anyway, I guess we have to step inside the exposition zone.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
I don't know if inside is part. Can you use that sort of direction with the exposition zone? It exists in a different dimension.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, what direction do you go into an anomaly? Yeah. Right? It's like...
up. Yeah.
You can get halfway into the anomaly. Or
so
are you still
Gattaca
going into...
is... Gattaca is about... So it starts off... how much do we need to get into it? I mean, there's so much I want to mention, but the bare bones essentials is... In a world with genetic engineering, there are people who, I guess, the last generation of people, I would say, who either their parents couldn't afford the engineering, or they happened to be born, like the main character, one of the last people born without, like, this extensive genetic engineering behind choosing their features and all that. And essentially, it's the tension of... how the people who are, like, you know, quote unquote genetically superior are elevated and the other people are discriminated against. And that's kind of the main thrust of the movie. And I just love how it sets it up, because it does set up as the main character is kind of, like I said, one of the last people born naturally, mm-hmm. you know, and in this that we know of, it doesn't explore much of the outer world. So I don't know if there's, like, going to be other places in the world where this is still normal. But for the society we're looking at, he is one of the last people born naturally. And the way it sets it up is so brilliant to me, because they at first it's like when he's born, for like the doctors are doing genetic tests on the baby, like, right as it's born, and telling the parents, like, everything about him. Well, a high probability of heart condition, you know, like, projected age of death is like 31 or something. So all this information, and it's really depressing the parents. And then to the point which I find really compelling, the father was going to give him his name and then decides not to once he hears kind of sort of these negative components of the genetic testing. And then later that the parents go on to have a second child, a brother of the main character. And he is genetically engineered to be, you know, as good as can be in every category. And he's the one who gets the father's name. And so that's our two. Well, that's our main character, I guess. That's his history. But and just to round out, I guess, the exposition and where the plot goes, the tension and the plot and the drama of it and everything is Ethan Hawke, the main character, Vincent Freeman, I guess his name is, and his brothers, yeah. Anton and all that. But the main plot is him trying to fulfill his dream of being an astronaut, traveling to space. Despite the fact that there's going to be discrimination against him based on his genetic profile. And so what he does is he talks to Monk. he talks to Tony Shalhoub, of course. And
playing weird Tony Shalhoub.
Somebody who pretty much being Tony Shalhoub, who I always love watching. Sure. I can't help it. I'm a Tony Shalhoub fan. And he's kind of a black market guy who deals in finding people with, you know, pristine genetic makeup, you know, who will pass the testing and all that to get into places, who have either had accidents or for whatever reason can't live up to their potential. And so what they do is they sell their genetic material in order to allow someone like Ethan Hawke, the main character, to assume their identity and get access to things they wouldn't normally have access to. And the person whose identity he takes is Jude Law. His character's Jerome. Name is Jerome. And so he becomes Jerome. Ethan Hawke becomes Jerome because Jude Law just had an accident out of the country where he became paralyzed. Mm. So that's I think, pretty much what we need to do plot-wise. Why don't you fill in about a million little holes I left in terms of what we need to discuss.
That's pretty good. I love the term that they use for the technique of borrowing someone else's DNA. They call it a borrowed ladder, and that it evokes the idea
that's nice.
a lot of things. It evokes the idea of sort of climbing the social ladder, but also people jumping ahead of the social game in some inappropriate way. But there's also reoccurring staircase and ladder symbolism in this movie. There's that giant staircase, when you think about it, looks a whole lot like a double helix DNA kind of thing, right? And they're constantly going up and down it. And so you get this idea of ascending, both biologically but also culturally. I love how much detail work there is sort of going on in the background like that.
Yeah, great point. I didn't even think of that because I'm so in love with what happens that I was like, I'm just paying attention to that. But there's so many little details that I love, and I would probably just spend the whole time fanboying about the movie. But we should talk some philosophy, right? Or what? Where do you?
Yeah, I guess I want to also point out the one woman in this, which I guess this is somewhat accurate, right? We might wonder how many women would be left if this sort of ability to choose everything about your children went to fruition in our current age, for example. One of the ethical concerns that people raise. But Uma Thurman is in the movie. And is the, of course, love interest of the main character, but also interesting in her own right as someone who is of the higher genetic echelon, but also has one minor defect. She has a heart condition. And so she's in this weird liminal world between the perfects and the imperfects.
Right.
And so that gives her some sympathy towards Hawk's character. But there's just a lot of really good stuff built into this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's little details like you talk about, you know, how many women would be left. That's always a really interesting ethical concern. Like, at what point would somebody have to step in and be like, hey, you're discriminating against a group of people, even though it's like an unborn group of people, you know, like that's a really interesting ethical question. But also one of the little plot points they came up with was that the main character, Ethan Hawke, is left-handed. And he has to learn to be right-handed because nobody chooses to have left-handers anymore, which I think this ignores the state of MLB baseball. Like, you're always going to want left-handed pitchers left-handed.
Well, you'd get genetically programmed left baseman like the piano player. So there's the guy with the genetically programmed extra finger. Yeah. Who can that comment she has at one point about how you can only play that piece with six fingers. So you're right. You would get some left-handed people, right? But you'd get people who are like, their father really, really wanted a first baseman, and so they make him left-handed.
Yeah, but I think one joke I made to Lydia while we were watching this is like, the most unbelievable aspect of this futuristic society is their thriving space program. Like, that was to me after the state of the world today. Like, back in 1997, it was like, oh yeah, we'll be launching stuff to space all the time. Rockets will be going to, you know, Jupiter's moons and all this stuff. And now it's like, nah. that's the most unbelievable part. I believe in all the genetic racism and just like, you know, discrimination. That I 100% believe, like, genetically refined discrimination, but perfected discrimination. But space,
like, Ethan Hawke's optimism. Happened. There's no way. There's no way that you ever get that. I get it. I understand. Mm-mm. I do like that they're thinking about the idea that genetic engineering would be a way to overcome some of the problems of spaceflight.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
That was something we chatted on a little bit in the previous episodes. And they,
oh, cool. They don't address it too explicitly, I don't think.
I mean, the idea is that it's okay for them to demand the highest caliber because of the rigors of spaceflight. Right. And that's why they can justify the discrimination.
Right. And I guess I'll just finish off this part of the show by saying the reason that I love this so much, not that I'm not, you know, it's not like I'm a terribly optimistic person, as you probably hear in this show. Like, I am kind of determinist. I'm kind of, you know, like, what's, you know, I don't believe in much. But this movie to me is, there's something about it. Like, if it's true that there is something, you know, unique and special about the human spirit, which I don't know that it is, but if it were true, this movie for me really illustrates it. This idea that there are people who, in the case of these two brothers, my favorite part about them is, about this story, is they used to have this swimming contest. So when they're, you know, they grew up as kind of rivals, but of course, Ethan Hawke was a little bit runty and a little bit, you know, shorter and skinnier and had wore glasses and all that. And his younger brother was taller than him and like, you know, because he's been genetically engineered. And they would have this contest where they would swim out into the ocean and, you know, first one to turn back loses, essentially. And of course, Ethan Hawke would always lose until a certain point. And this is what I love about this movie. And I honestly, I find it like incredibly moving and inspirational. At a certain point in their lives, Ethan Hawke realizes, his character realizes, I guess, he has just nothing to lose. And in a world where, you know, he's got all these disadvantages, he wasn't given the same advantages, and he's a massive underdog, he's able to start beating his brother in this swimming competition because he realizes, you know, he has no F's to give anymore. It's like, what, I'm not going to leave anything for the swim back, is what he says. And so he's able to win. And this idea that this like triumph of spirit, you know, this whatever you would call it, that it could that overcome these massive odds, I find it so compelling, and it's why I really love this movie.
Yeah, I would say that it's pushing back on the culture's genetic determinism and saying really strongly mm-hmm. that there is this other element, the will or something that's going on in here that can overcome even a less well-developed hand.
Yeah, and pair that with, and I find it very believable too. I mm-hmm. mean, to a certain extent, obviously, sure. Like, you know, if it's going to be a race or if it's going to be a simple competition, there are things that obviously if you're genetically engineered to be way better at, then you're going to be way better. But this idea, and there's the flip side of it too, is that we find out later in the movie that Jude Law didn't have an accident. We find out that he actually tried to kill himself. And so there's this flip side, mm-hmm. which is if you are genetically engineered to be this like incredible person, then what happens when you don't quite meet your expectations or your parents' expectations or society's expectations? And there's like a depression that he has. And also, I think we see it in Ethan Hawke's brother a little bit too. Ever since Ethan Hawke beat him this one time when they were a certain age in the swimming competition, it's like the brother could never get over that, you know, because it was like, I was supposed to win. I was, you know, I'm superior. I should have won. I should always win. And I find it very believable that there would be this immense pressure that could have psychological effects, you know, of both the psychological effects of, you know, being an underdog and all that, but also of being an overdog, of like mm-hmm. being the one that's supposed to always succeed. You know, like you, I could imagine that taking away your motivation or making it such, sort of like research has shown that if you tell kids they're smart, it's bad for them. Like, right. Or at least one of the book I read, you know, which I do really like, I think it was pretty science-based, but that you shouldn't tell your kids like, you're so smart. You should emphasize that they need to work hard, because if they just think they're smart, if they just think they're gifted, they'll think everything should come easily. And when it doesn't, then they don't know how to handle it. And it's kind of that kind of thing. I find it so believable and interesting.
I agree. And I think that you're bringing around to some sort of one of the things I wanted to do here was take this really great sort of clear cut story and use it as an example of like, What are the different main ethical theories? How do they respond to this, you know, continuously coming into the real world kind of ethical dilemma that, you know, parents like yourself are genuinely facing every day? I don't know if y'all did genetic screening or not, but I've had conversations.
Oh yeah, no, Phoebe is going to be a spider related. Like she's several legs. I think she's going to turn into a villain in some sort of comic book movie. That's usually how that goes.
Y'all didn't even did you do basic like disease screening at all?
I totally forget now, actually, but I think we did whatever. Yeah, I mean, we would have done whatever we could have. Mm-hmm. any sort of testing, yeah, like anything we can determine ahead of time, we would have done, yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting that you say it in that sort of cavalier, like obviously we would do that testing kind of way, because
yeah, definitely.
There are interesting ethical questions about should you provide people with that kind of information? It's similar to what you were saying, right, about the potential expectations game, right? If you tell someone you're going to be dead by 50 because of a heart attack, 99% mm-hmm. chance, that's going to completely alter their entire life trajectory than if you don't tell them that information. And that creates a very challenging ethical dilemma for genetic screeners on how they should present information, and especially knowing that the people they are presenting it to may not be well equipped to understand the complexities of the ways that genes interact with the environment to actually express themselves. That a lot of us come into this with this kind of naive deterministic view that, well, if I have this gene, I'm screwed. But mm-hmm. the realities are much more complex than that. And so the question is, how do you tell a parent, you know, they have this gene, which represents this potential possibility kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think that, amazingly, I don't know precisely what the state of the science was in 1997, but they did a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little, the part where they're reading the stuff as
it's dramatically
the baby's
done.
Just born. Yeah. Like that's obviously nonsense and no one would do that, but it's done for a purpose. And, but they read it in terms of probability, which I do like, because as you say, the truth of the matter is, from my understanding of the science, is that we've actually had a way harder time than we thought we would have, than we previously thought. We thought we'd be able to, scientists thought they'd be able to okay, this gene is that gene's that, or maybe some combination is that, and bam, presto, we can do whatever. But it's so complicated and it involves so many interactions together with genes and also with the environment that it's incredibly hard to predict. So mm-hmm. But I do like that they use probability. So this percent chance of this percent chance of this. I think the probabilities are way too high. they're way more confident than I think we
That's
would be.
The problem.
But still, for 1997 and it's a movie, so you're making some conceits. I think it's brilliant. I think it's really well done.
And I also don't think it's a mistake. I think it's a deliberate
playing
into, this is the worldview that this world has. And because of that worldview, you get this systemic oppression. So it's not just that this technology necessarily brings about inequality. It's that this technology plus this naive kind of genetic determinism leads the society to assume these really unrealistic, expectations of this programming.
Yeah. So philosophically, where do we go?
Well, I think I just wanted to point out, I think virtue theory, for example, would have probably the easiest time saying yes to all of this, because as far as I can tell within virtue theory, as long as you combine it with the idea that you still have to build up the habits and the genetics alone are not going to do anything for you, there would be no argument, as far as I could see, on that view from providing people the best potential from which to actualize their virtues. Whereas I think both deontology and utilitarianism will have a little bit harder time saying, I'm all in on this because of these various potential harmful effects that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and one thing I think sort of relates to that I wanted to point out. Now, this is major spoilery. I mean, mm-hmm. the whole thing, we have to spoil the whole thing. But part of the drama is very early on. One of the, I think it's the mission supervisor or something like that, is found dead. And you pretty much think that, it must have been the main character, must have been Ethan Hawke, because he probably found him out and was going to, turn him in or something like that. And so that's what you figure. And there's a whole investigation. And at one point, they're talking to this other guy, some other supervisor, I don't know, the actual position, a director or something.
The director.
And which is Gore Vidal, I think. Mm-hmm. And he says, the fact that he's even being questioned, he says, this is outrageous. Check my profile, my genetic profile. I have no disposition for violence, something like that, what he says. Yep. And then it turns out in the end that it was him who did it, and he did it because the launch window for this mission was once every 70 years, and he was never going to get to, see it again in his lifetime, and the mission director was going to cancel the mission. So that's why he killed him. And it's the other end of it. It's like, yes, that Ethan Hawke can overcome, his stuff, but also on the other side, someone who a character who has no predisposition to violence of any kind, if they're in a certain set of circumstances, can commit violence. And I love how it really does. The movie really does kind of hit all directions of this problem.
Yeah. I mean, they vary aggressively in the movie make a point about it being genetic profiling, that they're not doing, you know, the guy who wants to do the real investigation work is like being brushed off by the people who are like, no, look, we're going to gather up all the genetic samples, and if we find someone who is genetically right. inferior, that's our person. You know, it's basically racial profiling at an airport or any of these other kinds of
Yeah, and they're going to set up a dragnet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just like, there's just kind of the worst kind of corrupt policing.
But it's also a good comment on if you put this technology into the world and start telling people that this technology is a reliable indicator for how someone is going to be, then people will start to build that into their assumptions. And if you already have an unequal system, it can get very bad very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, how many people of color were there in this movie? Did you count them? And that
it was the '90s. It was a different time.
Right. But like,
but that's another question. Or was it intentional? I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. Right. But, like if it was intentional, it's a smart point that like another thing you might see is the weeding out of, you know, darker skinned individuals.
Yeah. I think the geneticist, and this is interesting, the geneticist that they're talking to in the beginning, I'm pretty sure, mm-hmm. where the parents are planning, you know, the second child who's going to be superior. I think that guy was black. I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. But that's an interesting question. Yeah. Like, is a already racist society just going to use this technology to make everything way more racist?
Yeah. And I want to before we run out of time, level my one critique of the movie, because I think it's also relevant to what we're talking about here, which is how the movie talks about erasure of disabled individuals. So you have this main character who's in a wheelchair who basically has to hide all the time. But there's a problem with the movie in that the person playing that person in a wheelchair is not actually a disabled individual, right? I understand why they wanted to bring in a very famous individual who is a high quality actor in order to, you know, get more attention to the movie. But it's a problematic irony that they are doing a movie about the erasure of disabled people and the incredibly important disabled character is not played by an actual disabled person.
Hmm. Yeah. And again, that's second to the casting of Ethan Hawke. That's problematic just at all. That, just because he sucks.
Different kind of casting.
But it's close. It's a close second. It's a close second. Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's, you know, it is 1997, and I think you can still enjoy the movie understanding that problem. But I think it's worth watching it through that lens, too, and saying, oh, yeah, that even in this attempt to raise a legitimate critique of where this could go, these people are still failing to get outside of their own cultural structure.
Right. I don't even think this movie, I don't think it did all that well. It did terribly.
I mean, it was sort of middling. And then picked up a following sort of after the fact. It's held on a lot better than you'd expect for how successful it actually was.
Ratings wise, it's great. Like it's got, but I'm pretty sure it was a box office flop.
Yeah.
So, even erasing disabled people by casting Jude Law in that role, like even that didn't overcome the, you know, like apparent box office woes. So yeah, no, it was 1997. It was a slightly different time. And nowadays, I hope that mistake wouldn't be repeated. Mm-hmm. But you just had the Scarlett Johansson thing, although she just dropped. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe there's hope.
Yeah, maybe there's progress. I do think I also want to push back a little bit on the, I mean, like you were just saying, obviously we'd get the testing done. But even with this kind of testing, I think there are ethical questions about, you know, abortion, and when, you know, there's a lot of pushback in various communities like hearing impaired and such, where they don't see their community as disabled, and they don't want to see their community go away merely because technology exists to ameliorate these issues.
This is a really interesting problem.
Yeah,
and this is something where I would say that I'll just confess my unpopular opinion here, but before I do so,
oh God, you're gonna Peter Singer us, aren't you?
Yeah, no, I would say that I think we should, you know, if well, I would put the a I would put the decision in the hands of, you know, first off the parents and. Or first and foremost, you know, the person having the child, I think it's decisions over, you know, their body, of course. Yeah. But also, when it comes to parents making a decision about their future and is their child going to have a condition that would be expensive for them to deal with, or, you know, can they manage that resources wise, that kind of thing. I think it's a tough problem, but I will say I am someone who was born with hearing loss. My left ear has very little hearing in
really?
It. And it was just a birth defect.
And yeah, you overcame that to be a podcaster. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah.
You are Ethan
but
Hawke.
No.
I'm so proud of you.
Yeah. But what I would say is I would happily have loved to have that fixed. Absolutely. Okay. You know, like, it's a, so, you know, as somebody mm-hmm. who genetically suffers from hearing loss, I'm not deaf, of course. I'm not, you know, fully can't hear anything. But I don't really understand it. I'll be honest. Like, it's a weird... I've seen this argument. It's very delicate. It's not something you want to just stumble clumsily into because it's, I get it. Like, it's really, it's a really difficult subject matter. It's a really, you know, people with dwarfism, for example, mm-hmm. don't, you know, they don't want to have their whole, they feel like their identity would potentially be erased. And mm-hmm. it's a really difficult ethical problem. And all I can say is, you know, for what I have wrong with me, which is, yeah, I've got a couple other things genetically too that I would love to have had fixed. That would have been nice. Mm-hmm. That's easy for me to say, I guess. But I wonder what the difference is. If it's something where if a person feels like it's, you know, X percent to put it, you know, to put it into number terms, even though I know that's not how we think. But if a person starts to think of whatever this condition or whatever it is, you know, this quality about them, if it's enough wrapped up in their identity to where they can't envision themselves without it, then I guess it feels like they'd be getting erased in a way if it was to be, you know, like eradicated. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, like if
their personhood might change substantially and they may not feel like they should be pressured into that. And that's sort of,
right.
I know we're running short on time, but like the last little pushback I would say is our liberal mindset is very, very strongly towards give people the choice. And I respect that. Mm-hmm. We have to be realistic that that choice occurs within the context of social pressure and that those social pressures might very easily drive people towards feeling compelled to have to make one choice or the other with so they avoid being looked at a certain way, perhaps. So I think,
it's really interesting. I think it's definitely something to navigate carefully, but I mean, for my part, when it comes to hearing loss, for example, there is a real sense where people with disability will say that they don't suffer from the disability. They suffer from how society treats them, as I think mm-hmm. you said earlier. And it's just an interesting thing. Like I think that that's absolutely true in many ways, but also I don't know that in a society where typically the society would identify a healthy individual as being able to see, for example, and with how much of our society is dependent on vision, you know, mm-hmm. like driving, you know, watching movies, all this stuff that's like, it is definitely geared toward sighted people. And I don't know if I would say like, therefore, it would be unethical, even though it's there are shortcomings in how we treat people with vision loss, for example. Does that mean that therefore we would be okay telling prospective parents that they can't fix, you know, a sight problem genetically in their child? It's a really interesting case. I can't see that being the right answer either. You know what I mean? Like. Yeah. As much as it's like, okay, it's uncomfortable to say, yeah, let's just get rid of all the people with X condition. Like, well, they'll never. And of course, when I say that, I mean people who will be born with that, not people currently, obviously. But it's like, okay, that sounds difficult and harsh. But also, if you flip it around, if you flip it around and say, okay, then the opposite of that, if that's not true, then parents are not allowed. Like, you should not be able to prevent certain conditions in your child. And that doesn't seem right either. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I support you. I agree with what you're saying. We've lost everybody now and it was a fun show while we had it. But no, I think you're doing a good job trying to.
Hey, I just come here to drop grenades and then be replaced by Callie Wright. when the listeners want to have me fired for confessing my unpopular opinion. hey, man, I'm not making this thing up about genetically I have hearing loss. So, yeah, like, I feel like I get to at least talk about that.
You're right. You have the hearing loss card. As a person
with hearing loss, would 100% wish that there was some way the doctors could have fixed that when I was, you know, in utero. Like, sure. I 1,000%. I would love to just be able to hear. And it's not, it's, you know, it's weird. I don't feel it. I know it might not be the same as a lot of, it's definitely not the same as a lot of other things, but I have a hard time thinking that my hearing loss in my ear, which is pretty bad, that is something that society's doing to me. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like, just fix it. Fix that for me, doctors. Like, I don't feel like there's another route, you know, like, where all audio could be balanced higher on the left side. Yeah. You know, like, it doesn't, the only route to it being better is someone fixing it, is how I feel. For me,
I understand what you're saying, right? There is a basic intuition. Now that you've already juggled all the grenades, I'll go ahead and say, right, there's a basic intuition where if I suddenly lost the ability to see, that would cause me major, major problems, right? And I would want that ability back, and I would struggle with not having it.
And side note, I didn't lose it. I never had.
Right. Just right. So people, what I'm saying is, yes. There is a one sense in which it makes sense to talk about this not having or losing as being something that harms whether or not society is able to compensate the individual as much as it can. I agree. And so that's why I think it is a hard problem, why you're right to say that this is not something that can easily be solved one side or the other.
And with that, our spineless co-host will not venture any sort of opinion on that.
Feel free to send me.
Your opinion was you agreed with how I framed the issue.
No, my opinion my opinion was that I am sympathetic to your claim that there is more than just the culture that is harming these individuals.
I'm just giving you a hard time. I'm happy to be the one, you know, who takes the heat on this show. I frequently am. And then you can shut the airlock and lock me out.
Yeah, my space like colonialism gets me no hate whatsoever.
That's true. I feel like we're both going to be flushed out of the system.
Yeah, we're just trolling our fans. I don't understand how anyone's listening at all.
Now we finally have the answer to how we ended up floating in space. Is we started talking, and then everybody was like, get these assholes out of our spaceship, and now we are floating in space. Oh, that's our origin story. We just came. Yep. All right. Well, I cannot believe that it's already time. That's depressing. But
We need to get a little more.
And we have more time over at After Dark. And if you thought I was going to save this controversial opinion for After Dark, you were wrong. But I'm sure there's more I could talk. Oh, no. I know what I want to tease for After Dark. I want to make a case for why this movie has the most compelling reference to the male sexual organ of anything, of Ethan Hawke. So Ethan Hawke's member features in the story, and it does so in a way that's actually compelling.
Oh my God.
I'm going to make that case. No, you're right. After Dark.
I look forward to that. I have I have an applied ethics story, but it's going to sound a little dry next to the penis story now. So okay. I also wanted to say, before we run out of time, that one of our listeners was really interested in hearing about Harrison Bergeron, and I am a big fan of the Harrison Bergeron story, and I am hearing your request, but it clearly needs to be its own episode, so we are going to, I think at some point, do a whole episode just on that.
I don't know what is that? Should I know what that is?
So it's a wonderful Kurt Vonnegut short story about a dystopian society where everyone is forced to be mediocre. And it does some really interesting questions.
Oh, yeah.
So
there was a TV movie of it.
Yeah, right.
And with Sean Astin.
I believe you. I don't know.
I was forced to watch it in high school. Oh, and I was like, the production of this is so bad, but it's an interest. I think the teacher was trying to make the case of like why it's, oh no, conceptually, probably like I was doing with Gattaca just now. No, but okay, that'll be interesting. Maybe we can watch the really terrible short TV movie.
Our first terrible movie. That.
All right, Aaron. Well, it's that time where we've got to thank our patrons and also give us an update on that. I was going to say raffle. That's not right. The drawing, whatever.
Raffle, drawing. I think those are both acceptable.
Okay. The drawing, the winner. The tell us about it.
Yeah. We successfully had our first ever Philosophers in Space patron raffle giveaway where I sent out some signed copies of the book that I edited this past year on Hamilton and philosophy, your favorite musical. I'm going to keep doing that forever. And our winners, I'm very happy to say, all responded. So we've sent out their books, and I just wanted to thank them again. That is Robert, Kristen, and Devin. All wonderful people who I had great chats with on email. Thank you all so much. And hopefully we can do another one of these sometime. Maybe eventually we get some Philosophers in Space merch going, and we could do a little raffle on that or something. That could be fun. But we also need to thank our top patron, as always. And this week, they're being very nice to me. They said, I'll give Aaron a break. Please just tell us your favorite word. So I got to split it between two words, like always.
Is your favorite word something you can't pronounce?
I got to cheaty this. Right. My favorite made-up word, and all words are made-up, but my favorite especially made-up word is scrumtralescent.
Yeah.
That's a classic. But philosophically speaking, if you want something with content, my favorite word is abide, because that is the core of my ethos. So... there you go.
Huh. The dude abides.
Is that what you're saying? The dude abides in non-action. Nothing is done, yet nothing is left undone.
Wow. Well, I just want to say that I do truly love this movie. I really do. So I hope you watched it. And if you didn't, sorry, we spoilered it, but still go watch it because there's compelling moments in the midst of some bad 90s acting, but that's okay. Thank you so much for listening. And we are going to see our patrons over at the After Dark segment. That is at patreon.com/0G. Catch us after dark. We've got a lot of fun stuff to talk about. And for everybody else, we'll see you next week.
That's all for the main show. But if you'd like to go to patreon.com/0G, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
I think it's just another one of these like FUs to genetic determinism. It's like, you know, even with all of his controlling, he still has this thing that the genetically controlled people want the most, which is giant swinging pipe, apparently. Glad the culture hasn't moved past an obsession with that.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/0G. You can find us on Twitter at @0GPhilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.